Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
A dangerous storm called Dorian bears down on the Sunshine State.
This is going to be a major hurricane, Category 4, potentially even Category 4 plus.
Also this week, officials say too many people with mental illnesses are being sent to the state's prisons and jails because getting treatment can often be a major barrier.
Even if you didn't have a mental illness, you would have a hard time getting the services that you need in our state.
We'll also delve into the question of whether it's a good idea to have a choice of electric power providers rather than Florida's current monopoly model, and we'll get an update on what happens when a charter school company takes over an entire county school district. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. As we go to air with this pre-Labor Day edition of Capitol Report, there's really only one story that most Floridians care about, and that's where will Hurricane Dorian land, and how much damage will it do to us once that happens? Well, this is Governor Ron DeSantis' first ever hurricane as governor, and he appeared at the state's Emergency Operations Center in Tallahassee this morning and urged Florida residents to hope for the best and prepare for the worst.
But you do have time before it reaches to prepare if you have not done so. And so we urge all Floridians to have 7 days worth of food, medicine, and water. This is potentially a multi-day event where it will churn slowly across the state. That obviously creates a whole host of issues, but if you're in an area that has an impact from this storm, you know, you should assume you're going to lose power.
Of course, no matter where and when the storm lands, there are likely to be many thousands of people fleeing the coastal areas in particular. So Governor DeSantis said the shoulders of major highways would be open to traffic. Also, with extensive gasoline shortages already reported as motorists top off their tanks in advance of a possible evacuation, the governor said fuel supplies were another priority.
We have a lot of fuel in Florida. It's just we have limited capacity to bring it from the port to the gas stations because you can only have so many trucks at one time doing that. And so recognizing that, we've worked with FEMA to get fuel from out of state.
The state also has its anti-price gouging hotline up and running through the office of Attorney General Ashley Moody. And late this afternoon, President Trump responded to Governor DeSantis's request for a federal emergency declaration. So that's in place now. There's much more we could say about Dorian and Florida's preparations thereof, but the storm situation is literally changing hour by hour. So your best bet, keep listening to your local public radio station for the latest and most accurate account of what's going on, and please be safe. With the number of prisoners requiring mental health treatment on the rise, Florida Attorney General Ashley Moody is asking stakeholders to weigh in on possible solutions. Regan McCarthy has more.
Throughout the United States, an estimated 2 million people with mental illnesses are put behind bars each year. The National Association on Mental Illness says 83% of those inmates don't have access to the mental health treatment they need. And in Florida, the story isn't much different.
It's estimated that in Florida, over 134,000 people a year with serious mental illnesses are arrested and booked into our jails. And on any given day, Florida has about 17,000 state prison inmates, 9,500 local detainees, and 35,000 individuals under correctional supervision in the community who experience serious mental illnesses.
Judge Steve Lifeman sits on Florida's 11th Judicial Circuit Court in Miami. He started a mental health court that works to divert people to treatment facilities rather than sending them to jail. Attorney General Ashley Moody is praising Lifeman's work. She says jails aren't typically set up to help people with mental illness.
Our sheriffs, in many respects around the state, are dealing with not only managing the jails, but they're dealing with having to now be in charge of dealing with substance abuse issues and mental health issues and making sure that those are addressed within the jail system.
Moody says 24 of Florida's 67 counties now have some kind of mental health court, and she's hoping to see that number grow.
We have made a great progress in making this an issue and making it a specialized issue within our courts. And it seems to me like this is the critical moment where we might see additional courts being developed, and I want to make sure that we're all focusing on the best ways to do that.
But Lifeman says addressing Florida's mental health needs will take more than mental health courts can accomplish alone.
The reality is, in some ways, the courts, particularly in the criminal system, are the repository for some failed public policies. And we end up with the problem that we are not necessarily capable of fixing. And so while the courts, the mental health courts, are tremendous and they're doing great work, they're very limited and they're only one piece of what needs to be fixed to fix the real big problem.
Lifeman says the state is spending about $850 million on incarcerating people with mental illness, but just a small percent of that is spent on mental health treatment.
20% of the entire adult mental health budget for the state of Florida goes to trying to restore 3,300 people, while at the same time we have 130,000 plus people who are getting arrested with serious mental illnesses. That might be okay if those 3,300 people were charged with really heinous offenses and needed to be off the street. But for 70% of those individuals, three things happen to them. The charges are dropped, they get credit for time served, or they get probation, and they walk out of the front door of our courthouses without any access to treatment, sometimes getting rearrested within minutes of the release because there's no warm handoff from these facilities into the community system.
Lifeman says the mental health system is incredibly fragmented and difficult to navigate.
Even if you didn't have a mental illness, you would have a hard time getting the services that you need in our state.
Lifeman says more needs to be done, particularly on the front end, to help people get treatment before they even enter the criminal justice system. He says Florida has the fourth highest rate of adults in the country who have mental illness but are not insured. Meanwhile, the state ranks among the lowest when it comes to per capita spending on mental health care. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Still to come on Capitol Report, would having a choice of power companies provide the same competitive benefits as having a choice of cell phone services? One very savvy utility expert still has some questions.
The amendment would force people to then eliminate barriers to the investigation of these other sources, potential sources of power.
The American Civil Liberties Union believes financial obligations shouldn't be allowed to stop a felon from registering to vote as long as they've completed their sentence. Legislation signed in June requires full payments of any financial obligations, but the ACLU thinks that's not what the 2018 amendment called for.
I think if you look at the amendment text, you won't find fees, you won't find fines, you won't find court costs, you won't find restitution, you won't find financial obligations. You will find nothing in the amendment that says your voting rights depend on your wealth.
And when an entire Florida school district failed, a charter takeover was supposed to be its salvation. But has it worked as its advocates hoped?
They did all these things that helped to make the school feel and look better and, you know, to give extra help to the students in terms of tutoring and after school and that kind of stuff.
A proposed amendment to Florida's Constitution would deregulate and open up competition for investor-owned utility companies. This week, attorneys for the amendment's backers faced tough questions from the Florida Supreme Court about its ballot language. Brian Armstrong is an attorney who has decades of experience representing utilities, not only in Florida, but also in New York and New Jersey. He spoke with Ryan Daly about what's dubbed the Florida Energy Choice Initiative.
you know, I wanted to start off with the basics in layman's terms, describing what this Energy Choice Amendment looks to do.
As I read the Energy Choice Amendment, it looks to create for the electric industry what was done decades ago with the telephone industry, and which was done in the 1980s, I believe it was, in the natural gas industry. And basically, it's called unbundling. It's called an unbundling of services. For natural gas, what was unbundled was utilities that previously hunted for the gas and secured the gas from the earth and then transported it to customers. It was unbundled so that they had to create different companies where one company actually searched for the gas and got it out, and then a separate company acting independently had to transport that gas to a customer for the customer's use. So the second company was marketing the customer and doing the retail sales to customers. And basically what happened there was it gave the end-use customer a choice to go look for different gas providers around the country. And that is the long and short of what this amendment is intended to do. It is intended to unbundle the act of generating power, the act of electricity, and unbundle that from the act of selling it to a consumer.
So on its face, consumer choice, you know, always kind of sounds like a good thing. But, you know, opponents kind of point to Texas as a state that's done essentially the same thing. And they say rates have gone up. So, you know, help us wrap our mind around the mindset of the people who oppose this thing.
Well, let me start with if I were a proponent of this, if I was a proponent of unbundling, I would look at what happened in the telephone industry. I would look at what happened in and is happening in 18 states across the United States. And I would pick at and choose the developments that have happened that have worked to unbundle electric service, because it's happened already. And I don't know why there's not more emphasis and more analysis on what is happening over there to determine really, is it working? Ryan, I just wonder too, and again, I don't have any dog in this hunt. I'm not working for anybody in this regard. But I wonder whether or not the amendment is here a bit too soon, because I believe that distributed power, which is power that, if you just think about a solar panel on a home or a house, that's distributed power. There are a lot of fuel cell technologies being investigated. There are investigations now about whether you can have at your house equipment put into the ground to work with the thermal heat in the ground and actually produce power for yourself. That is the future. I think that will come. And this, if people knew that they could do that and it would be cheaper and they'd have their own source of power, I think they would be totally supportive of this amendment. However, we're not there. And that is not available to us, so the proponents of this can't suggest that it is. It's coming, though. I think if this amendment passed, it likely would come a lot sooner, because the amendment would force people to then eliminate barriers to the investigation of these other sources, potential sources of power. And I think money would flow to that, just like we've seen money flow to solar when things started to open up. In Florida, people know about water situation and the water scarcity. In parts of Florida decades ago that I worked with some utilities, they were doing reverse osmosis treatment. They were taking salt out of the water and producing clean water for people. It was unheard of then, but it's happening more and more in Florida, and it's getting cheaper and cheaper because people are now investing in those technologies. That's what would happen if this amendment passed today.
So, you know, all that said, do you think that the opponents, at least in the, you know, in the short term or in the immediate, do you think they have a point that it wouldn't be a consumer-friendly amendment?
Again, I would look to see what it did with telephone, and I would look to see what it did with natural gas. Having done utility rate making and represented utilities for quite some time, I do think that one concept hasn't been investigated yet, and that is when a utility, these investor-owned utilities, go before the Public Service Commission and they get their rates set, they are allowed a return on the investment that they make, and that's what they're trying to protect, the return that they make in these generating plants. The return they get is modulated by the PSC depending on risk. Is it risky to make that investment? And for years, the utilities have argued it is risky because there are regulatory risks and there are industry risks, and that is the risk they've been talking about is just this very fact, that technologies might come along that make them obsolete. So for years, they've been getting a higher return, 10, 12, 13, 15% return, because the PSC has recognized, you know, you're right, you're making a risky investment. Well, I think we should be looking at the fact that if that's the case, and they've been compensated in rates by customers all these years for a higher risk, if now that risk comes to pass, I don't know that we should be saying that the utility should be able to recover their what they call stranded costs, the costs in that generating plant, if they don't sell enough power to recover those costs, because now people can go buy power themselves. I think that's something that has to be looked at. And I think if I was a utility, I'd be concerned about that happening. But the question is, from the customer's perspective, have we been paying all along to compensate them for that risk that they've been taking?
That was utilities attorney Brian Armstrong. He spoke with Capital reporter Ryan Daly. The American Civil Liberties Union is challenging the constitutionality of a law that allows certain felons to vote, but requires them to pay any fees associated with their sentence first. Critics call the new law a poll tax, but the bill's author argues he simply followed the language voters approved in the 2018 amendment. Now the judge presiding over the case is questioning whether the amendment itself violates the Constitution. Blaise Gainey spoke with ACLU lawyer Julie Ebenstein to get the group's view.
Ebenstein doesn't think the judge's question is a big deal.
We certainly think Amendment 4 is constitutional. We've never claimed Amendment 4 is unconstitutional. We're not challenging the constitutionality of Amendment 4. The judge in a discovery hearing simply asked for briefing on a particular issue, what he would do and how he would order relief in one scenario. So I think what's clear is that the bill that we are challenging, the legislation that we're challenging, 7066, is such a departure and such a modification of Amendment 4.
Tampa Bay Republican Representative Jamie Grant sponsored the bill. He says he followed exactly what an amendment passed by voters said. But Ebenstein thinks the financial obligations weren't part of the amendment. She says they were added on by the legislature.
The legislation that was passed in May, signed by Governor DeSantis in June, it has a complex array of definitions and requirements for the different financial obligations that people have to satisfy before they can have their right to vote restored. So what we're challenging is the requirement that people have to satisfy those financial obligations before they can restore their fundamental right to vote.
Grant's reason for adding fees, fines, and restitution as part of the completion of sentence is because the amendment included parole and probation, something he says is inherently a financial obligation. Ebenstein disagrees.
The idea that parole or probation, be having your life under the supervision of the Department of Corrections or another state agency, the idea that that is merely a financial obligation is outrageous.
Ebenstein says no references to financial obligations were included when activists crafted the amendment, something she believes was done intentionally.
I think if you look at the amendment text, you won't find fees, you won't find fines, you won't find court costs, you won't find restitution, you won't find financial obligations. You will find nothing in the amendment that says your voting rights depend on your wealth.
Grant says when John Mills, an attorney for the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, defined completion of a sentence to the Florida Supreme Court during the amendment's advisory hearing, Mills said it included full payment of any fines. But Ebenstein says creating a definition was not the point of the meeting. Therefore, she says Grant's argument isn't valid.
That hearing was only on the single subject rule, which means to make sure that the language of Amendment 4 was clear. And what the state Supreme Court decided after those arguments was that the language of Amendment 4 was clear, and what it does is it automatically restores somebody's right to vote.
Meanwhile, Ebenstein says people across the state are waiting to find out whether they'll be allowed to vote in the next election.
One of our clients is 62 years old. She's never been qualified to vote, right? And she was thrilled on January 8th. That meant a lot to her. So to have that withdrawn by legislators in May and then signed by the governor in June, I think was heartbreaking for a lot of Floridians.
I'm Blaise Gainey.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, in 2017, Jefferson County became the state's first charter school district. The move came amid pressure from the Florida Department of Education and followed a decade of poor student performance and financial struggles for the small rural district of fewer than 800 students. The district consolidated its elementary school into its middle high school campus and closed its alternative school. It hired charter school operator Somerset Academy to take over, and most of the teachers and administrators lost their jobs. Some were later rehired at the charter school. In the first year, Jefferson saw its school grade jump from an F to a B before later being revised down to a C. Last year, its elementary school earned a D. A new documentary from Florida public media station WLRN and reporter Jessica Bakeman takes a closer look at what happened behind the scenes in the run-up to that conversation and how it's working for students and their families. Lynn Hatter speaks with Bakeman about her reporting on Jefferson County schools.
Jessica Bakeman, thank you so much for joining us here today. We're talking about your new series, Chartered. It's a series, a documentary that looks at Jefferson County becoming the state's first charter school district. Give us some background. Why did you choose to focus on Jefferson County schools?
Sure. So obviously now I work for WLRN, the public radio station in South Florida. But at the time, actually about 3 years ago in the summer of 2016, that was when the State Board of Education first started having conversations about what to do about the situation in Jefferson County, where the schools had been earning D's and F's for a very long time. The financial situation was a mess. And at the time, I was working for Politico, and I was based in Tallahassee covering state government. So I was at all these meetings of the State Board of Education where they were talking about it. And then shortly after that, as the process continued, where the State Board basically told the school district, you know, you have a couple of choices, and they really pressured them toward the charter school choice. That was happening at the same time the legislative session started up. And this was when now Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran, who was a speaker of the Florida House at the time, he was pushing his one of his major priorities during that session, the 2017 legislative session, which was this Schools of Hope law. And a part of pushing that, a lot of legislators kept name dropping Jefferson County. You know, it kind of became this anecdote of a poster child of public school failure, ripe for private intervention, an argument that, you know, more money isn't what's needed to fix failing schools. Rather, we need this radical change, bringing in this case, a charter school operator from South Florida. So that's when I started to get interested in it. And then when I moved to South Florida for this job, you know, there's a really important South Florida connection with this as well, of course, which is Somerset Academy, the charter school operator that is now running the schools in Jefferson County. So I was able to keep working on the story, and, you know, now we have a documentary and a series on our website, which is WLRN.org/chartered.
You know, you talk about that argument, right, that it's not a money problem. Perhaps we need a completely different direction. But as this experiment in a chartered operated district has shown us, it's likely a combination of both. The Jefferson County School, at one point there was a separate elementary school. It's now merged all into one building. And they got money from the state to boost teacher salaries to create additional programs into that school.
Right. So that was one of the things I was looking at, especially because legislators had so often said, Jefferson County spends so much per student and still the schools are failing. Clearly, we need something other than money. And certainly, you know, there was an influx of resources, not just in terms of dollar bills. You know, you have all of this attention focused on it. You have Somerset, which is in itself a very big network of charter schools, many of which are very successful. And it's also connected to some other charter school networks, and they were sending people up to Jefferson County to do teacher trainings and all that kind of stuff. But there were several monetary funding streams that were really helpful to Jefferson County for the takeover. And one of them was a $2 million federal grant that was a startup grant for charter schools that they got right out the gate when they first opened the schools in August 2017. Also, in 2018-19, the more recent school year, they received $2.25 million from the Schools of Hope program, the state program that Richard Corcoran championed. And they also were able to take out a couple $1 million in loans from Somerset, the parent company, so to speak, the charter school organization that they are a part of. And that money made a huge difference. You know, they increased teacher salaries to among the highest in the state. They renovated the school buildings. They replaced the gym floor. They gave the students uniforms. They replaced the band instruments. You know, they did all these things that helped to make the school feel and look better, and, you know, to give extra help to the students in terms of tutoring and after school and that kind of stuff.
So the question is, you know, we've had this influx in money. We are now seeing this charter operator that's working in there. Is it working? How is it working?
The elementary school had last earned a C in 2009 and the middle high in 2003. So, you know, many people made the argument or pointed out the fact that that's pretty much a whole generation of students. There were many students who maybe were never in a school with a passing grade. So to see in the first year those grades come up to C's really is dramatic and a tremendous achievement. And then, as you mentioned, in the second year, the middle and high schools maintained their C's. The elementary went back down to a D. However, they were one percentage point below a C based on the state's rubric for school grades. So, you know, I think part of the academic performance aspect to think about is that school grades are based in part on improvement. And there was tremendous improvement from you know, before the charter school takeover to year one. And even though there was that much improvement, still most of the students failed English and math, this state English and math tests. So, you know, that improvement really boosted things, which made it really hard to maintain that and continue that going into the second year, because you can only improve that much, you know, so many times. So we'll see going forward. You know, it's only been 2 years in terms of, you know, whether it's a success, whether it's working. I think it's probably too early to say. And certainly my documentary, my project, was not intending to make a blanket statement about whether it has been successful or not. What's important about that is the fact that the legislature has already said it's a success and has already said we should try to replicate this. We should try to do this more. And this Schools of Hope program that Jefferson was the first school district to benefit from is now being expanded, and we're going to see new charter schools of hope popping up all over the state, including in Miami, the Tampa Bay area, and Jacksonville.
Jessica Bakeman, thank you so much for joining us here today to talk about your new documentary, Chartered, Florida's first private takeover of a public school system.
Thanks for having me, Lynn.
That was Capitol reporter Lynn Hatter with the Jessica Bakeman interview. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, the aforementioned Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Again, stay tuned to your hometown public radio station for the latest storm information. And after Dorian has passed, please join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org.